Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. Days of speculation, rhetoric and behind-the-scenes negotiations come to a head in less than 2 hours' time when the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky meets Donald Trump at the White House. Not long ago, it looked as if Ukraine was being completely cut out of all talks about its future and a possible peace deal with Russia. Indeed, those negotiations between the US and Russia are continuing without Kyiv's direct input. But now Mr. Zelensky will have an opportunity to put his case and to sign an outline deal with the US about exploiting Ukraine's extensive mineral deposits. And some of President Trump's language about his Ukrainian counterpart seems to be softening. Yesterday, during the visit by Britain's Prime Minister, he described him as very brave, a point brought up in the news conference by the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason.
Mr. President, do you still think that Mr. Zelensky is a dictator?
Did I say that? I can't believe I said that. Next question.
Well, even if the US is able to negotiate a ceasefire with Russia, the big question for Ukraine and, indeed, its European allies is whether Vladimir Putin would honour the terms of the agreement. This was President Trump's response.
I've known him for a long time now, and I don't believe he's going to violate his word. I don't think he'll be back. When we make a deal, I think the deal's going to hold. Now, they're going to have security. You're going to have security. Yep. You're going to have soldiers. I know France wants to be there. He's... The president has said he wants to have soldiers there. I don't think we're going to even be necessary, but I don't think there'll be any problem with keeping the deal with the security.
Let's talk to the BBC's Tom Bateman, who joins us from Washington. And Tom, from that, it doesn't sound like Donald Trump's going to give much ground on security guarantees. Is that where we're at?
Well, I think it's exactly comments like that from President Trump yesterday that will have sent shudders through President Zelensky and everyone else in Ukraine, frankly, because it is the very core of what Mr. Zelensky is not just requesting, but demanding, basically, as part of any agreement with the United States, that there is a US-backed security agreement. Now, what the Europeans are interpreting that as is, at the very least, United States air cover, the ability to send planes over Ukraine to enforce a peace to ensure that Russia doesn't basically reinvade or try to restart the war in the event of a truce. Now, Mr. Trump has been has very much played down the possibility of that. He hasn't ruled it out entirely, but has said when it comes to security guarantees, quote, I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much. We're going to have Europe do that. So still seeing it very much as the job of the Europeans, as he says they're the next door neighbour to Ukraine. The Europeans are deeply unhappy with that position. We've had, you know, the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer yesterday in the White House again saying that he wants United States security backup or a backstop, as he calls it, in order for there to be European peacekeeping troops in Ukraine in the event of a truce. So it seems like this position is deadlocked. As Mr. Zelensky arrives at the White House making that key demand, he has basically said that a ceasefire is impossible if there isn't a US security guarantee for Ukraine.
Tom, many thanks. That was the BBC's Tom Bateman in Washington. Well, also on the line is Oleksiy Goncharenko, Ukrainian MP for the opposition European Solidarity Party. Oleksiy joins us from Kyiv. Welcome to NewsHour. How worried are you about the apparent lack of a security guarantee in the event of any peace deal?
Hi, security guarantee is definitely one of the crucial elements of the deal, because without it, Russia will just use this time to prepare for next invasion, next attack. So it's a crucial and essential part of any deal.
And what happens if your president, Mr. Zelensky, is unable to secure any sort of guarantees? What should he do, in your view?
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
Yeah, what should Mr. Zelensky do if he's unable to secure any guarantees about future security? How should he handle that?
I think in this case there is one word which could be said. This word is no. no to such deal. That's all. But I hope this will not happen. I'm not speaking now about this deal on Ukrainian natural resources. By the way, it's not only about rare earths. It's about everything, oil, gas, and even infrastructure like ports and everything. But I mean, in the end of the day, as a final deal with the Russians, it should include several key things. First is, even it looks like part of our territories will be still occupied by Russians after this deal, but they should have a status of illegally occupied. So our territorial integrity, while being violated, de facto should be secured de jure. Secondly is our sovereignty should be secured, meaning that we are making our own choices about what Ukraine is doing, where it's coming, what army we have, and so on. And thirdly, security guarantees. If it will not be in the deal, in this case, we can't accept it, I think.
Just on the minerals deal and other natural resources, as you say, does that in itself offer any future security for Ukraine? Are you seeing it in those terms?
No, I don't. I mean, we can say that from some point of view, a little bit, in fact, that American companies will be active in Ukraine, or some money from Ukrainian resources will come to American budget and things like this, it will increase interest in Ukraine from the United States, but it's definitely not security guarantee. We saw how in 2014 Russia attacked and occupied Crimea, where it was also American business or part of Donbass. There is many cases. So itself, it's not a security guarantee.
It looks as if Ukraine is having to give quite a lot. I mean, we're in the early stages, obviously, of any peace negotiations, but also giving up some of the rights to those minerals. Is Russia having to give anything up at this stage? How do you see it?
It's a good question. We will see. I mean, from my point of view, what is also should be included, it's keeping at least most of the sanctions against Russia, better all sanctions. Also, we should seize Russian frozen assets. That is very important. And also, President Trump said about some territories which can be returned to Ukraine, which are now controlled by Russians. So there are things which can be taken from them too, and I hope that will happen.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. That was Alexei Goncharenko, Ukrainian MP, who represents the European Solidarity Party, an opposition party, joining us live from Kyiv. Well, let's also talk to General Jack Keane, a former Vice Chief of Staff of the US Army, now Chairman of the Institute for the Study of War in Washington, D.C. General Keane, thank you very much for joining us on NewsHour. Why do you think the Trump administration is so reluctant to offer Ukraine those explicit security guarantees in the event of a truce?
I don't think they want to do that until they get into detailed discussions with Putin. And frankly, I disagree with some of the statements that were made. I think what's happening here, this deal, is overwhelmingly positive for Ukraine. Frankly, it ties the United States economically and politically with security implications to Ukraine for a generation. That's what we got on the table here. It's a major, major step in the right direction for Ukraine. And I'm putting aside the emotional disagreements that both presidents had. This is a positive step forward. I think all of that will be in the rearview mirror.
So looking ahead then, if the negotiations with Russia do bear some fruit, do you think, though, there will need to be some security guarantee for Ukraine in order to deter Vladimir Putin from future action?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What the United States team doesn't want to do is disclose that now. I mean, that's where we're at. They had the second discussion with Russia's people yesterday, and their conclusion on that discussion is Russia is predictably taking a hardline view, and the jury's out whether Russia is really serious about negotiations. Their claim yesterday to our U.S. team negotiators is they want more territory from Ukraine than what they're occupying. You know, their claim is to the four provinces, Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, but they don't own all the territories within those four provinces. And that's their initial going in claim. And they pretty much want to go back to the Istanbul Protocol and force Ukraine to demilitarize. 85,000 soldiers can't fire a missile beyond 40 kilometers, go to elections, which they will undermine. If they maintain those positions, that Russian narrative, hardline positions, we're quite a distance from a deal. And that's one of the reasons why the Trump administration isn't going to get into pre-deal negotiations in terms of what are we going to guarantee, what are we not going to guarantee. I mean, Zelensky and his team, I'm in contact with them, higher officials than the one you were just talking to, and they're going to put a claim out in the negotiation today. They're going to ask for U.S. assistance, not in terms of troops on the ground, I don't believe, but certainly in terms of building an air force around the F-16, long-range missiles, air defense systems, tanks, armored vehicles, artillery. All anybody can make a list of what they absolutely need to have here. And look at
Okay,
if you don't want to talk to me, that's
no,
fine.
I just wanted to elaborate on that. Would that be American planes or Ukrainian planes?
The United States is conducting ISR classified operations every single day and providing intelligence on what the Russians are doing and where they are at every single day to Ukrainians. That is happening as we speak. There's no reason to stop that.
Is there a danger here, just finally, of a frozen conflict? I mean, in some ways, it's been frozen for many years now. But is that what the future might look like for Ukraine?
Well, I think that's it. That's in doubt. I mean, certainly the United States has already stated they want Ukraine an independent sovereign nation whose future is secure. That's actually written into the economic deal that's going to be signed today. And so there's no doubt about that. Listen, what people react to is how Trump does personal diplomacy. He believes this is his way of doing business. You can't talk him out of it. And I've had discussions with him on this subject. He promotes the relationship publicly. He believes by doing that and lending favor to an adversary, he knows full well that Putin's a thug, a killer, he's committed genocide, and the narrative he wants in terms of taking Ukraine, knows full well that a peace agreement could actually lead to a re-attack by Russia. He knows all of that. But he wants to promote that relationship publicly. And by doing so, the media gets hyped up by it, understandably. Okay. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong in that. And it creates an environment that looks like Ukraine is going to be vulnerable in these
General
negotiations.
Key, we'll have
Russia
to,
is going to be favored.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up later on the program, we'll hear about the new Oscar-nominated documentary telling the tale of CIA subversion in 1960s Africa under the cover of jazz.
The US, the CIA in particular, are plotting with the Belgian to overthrow and eventually assassinate Patrice Lumumba. But that means speaking about the minerals of DR Congo, that means the Cold War, the jazz and the jazz ambassadors.
More on that coming up in just a few minutes' time. Our main headlines from the newsroom this hour. Hundreds of thousands of protesters have clashed with police in Athens as huge demonstrations take place across Greece, marking 2 years since its worst ever train crash. We'll have more on that in about 15 minutes. And China has accused the United States of blackmailing it over tariffs. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, ever since Donald Trump came into office, he's been piling the pressure on Mexico, threatening tariffs on Mexican imports because of what he says is the country's failure to deal with mass migration across the US southern border and the flow of illegal drugs, especially fentanyl. Well, in a move that's been widely seen as an attempt to deal with those concerns, Mexico has now sent 29 alleged drug cartel members to the US, including at least three former leaders of the gangs, among them Rafael Caro Quintero, who's wanted in the US for the murder of an American agent back in the 1980s. Well, let's speak to Juan Grillo, a journalist and author of several books about the cartels. He's on the line from Mexico City. Welcome to NewsHour. How significant is this move by Mexico, first of all?
It's absolutely huge, this. I mean, this is no ordinary process. Nothing like this has ever happened before. It's 29 in one day. And these are major figures. I mean, not only Rafael Caro Quintero, as you mentioned, two bosses of the Zetas, who are a really brutal cartel, but also the former head of the Juarez cartel, the brother of El Mencho, leader of the Jalisco cartel. And it was a very audacious move by President Claudia Sheinbaum. It does trample on the appeals that people were making against extradition, these various cartel figures. Some of them were not even in extradition process. And in fact, the officials are not talking about extradition. They're saying they were transferred into American custody or expelled or using different terms. But it does trample on that. And one thing it does is that normally when an extradition process goes through, the United States signs a waiver saying they will not impose the death penalty on them because that do not have death penalty in Mexico. That is not the case now. So these people are exposed for the death penalty. So it really is. I mean, for those of us who are really watching this, this is a big surprise, the level of this, and it really is a big blow to the cartels.
Well, I was going to ask you that. I mean, many of the figures, or at least the big names that you talked about, I mean, they've been out of the picture for a while, haven't they? Will it have a big impact on the cartel's business, do you think?
Well, there's obviously a system with the cartels that they actually have. Their networks of organized crime that have hundreds of thousands of people working for them. And there's always going to be somebody else who can cook up some fentanyl, cook up some crystal meth, smuggle it over. However, there has been a situation in Mexico for the last two decades where the cartels have been extremely powerful and extremely bullying of Mexican institutions, as well as corrupting and buying Mexican institutions and hitting all of their leaders in this way. Their leaders don't want to go to US prisons or face the death penalty. They like being in Mexican prisons where they can often still work and operate and run cartels. It shows a certain shift of power. Like, is this a movement of power? And this will lead to the Mexican government cracking down, moving more on them. But as you said, the actual daily operations, there'll be other people who can fill their roles.
Is there a danger then, from what you said, that there might be some blowback for the Mexican authorities?
Absolutely. I think that is a very genuine concern. I mean, if you look at what cartels have done the last 20 years, they've carried out, you know, massive amounts of murder of politicians, of mayors. I mean, you've seen them do things like shoot down a military helicopter with an RPG-7. They murdered one head of the federal police in his own home. They murdered a candidate for a governor of one state. So absolutely. I mean, in fact, the head of security in Mexico, the security chief, kind of security czar, Omar Garcia Harfuch, already survived one assassination attempt a couple of years ago in Mexico City. And I think he was a big person involved in this planning, and someone would definitely be stressed there. So I'm sure there's a lot of security around Mexican officials.
Thank you very much. That was Juan Grillo joining us live there from Mexico City. More than 50,000 people are thought to have fled the fighting in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, fled into neighbouring Burundi, risking their lives by swimming across a deep river. More than 20 people have died in just the past 2 weeks. Well, those who made it claim that if they stayed in the DRC, they would have been forced into conscription by M23 rebels. But there are fears that even in Burundi, they're not safe from the group. Nomsa Maseko reports.
A perilous journey across the river Rusizi from the DRC to Burundi. Possessions including jerry cans are used as a life raft. The journey is frightening for both adults and children. In the distance, in the middle of the river, I can see a man wearing a cap being pushed by the current. He's clinging on to a huge black bag which he pushes in front of him. As he emerges from the river, he wipes his face and takes a deep breath. He then goes straight to Burundian forces nearby who want to make sure he's not carrying any weapons. His name is Jordan Beater.
I managed to flee DRC safely because I was crossing through the forest and moving along the bushes instead of the main road. This is because M23 fighters are everywhere and they are forcing us to join them.
The BBC has not been able to independently verify this claim. In the last 2 weeks, at least 20 people, including children, have been swept away as they attempt to swim up to 300 meters across a river which at some point is 10 meters deep. It is thought many other drownings have been unreported. Jordan is among the lucky ones who made it. They say the choice is stark. Either stay and risk forced conscription into the M23 or swim and risk the waters of the Rusizi. Amani Sebakungu agrees with Jordan.
In the river, you just have to take heart and say, if I die or survive, so be it. God willing, I cross safely.
We are interrupted by the Burundian troops who order us to vacate the area. They've spotted M23 rebels marching towards the river border. Safety in Burundi means living in makeshift camps like this one here in Rugombo. As many as 25 people share a tent and food is rationed to only one meal a day. 87 years old and blind, the lines on Magega Mwaruya's face tell the story of the hardship she's endured since the 1960s.
I have fled to Burundi so many times since I was young, before I turned blind. There have been times where I almost drowned.
With the recent rapid advance of the M23 rebellion, Granny Magega must be wondering if she'll ever go back to her home country.
Nomsa Maseko reporting there. You're listening to the BBC. This is the BBC in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. There have been dramatic scenes in the Greek capital Athens today, with hooded protesters taunting police and throwing petrol bombs in the city's main square. Earlier, tens of thousands of people gathered for a rally demanding justice for the 57 victims of Greece's worst train crash 2 years ago today. There's also been widespread strike action across the country, with flights and ferry journeys suspended. Doctors and teachers also took part. I've been talking to Helena Smith, Athens correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. She's been telling me, first of all, about the scenes today in the capital.
Athens today has been the scene of unprecedented demonstrations. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in central Syntagma Square, the location of the Greek Parliament, on this, the second anniversary of the country's worst railway disaster in history, and to protest the lack of headway in resolving getting to the bottom of this train accident, the fact that no government official has been punished for this accident, and we still don't know what has happened. A trial 2 years on has yet to take place.
Are these protests and also strike action, I mean, has that been replicated across the country too?
It very much is. Similar protests have taken place in over 200 towns and cities across Greece. People have gathered in the central squares of those towns, and we're not talking about small protest rallies. We're talking about demonstrations, the likes of which I, during many years of reporting here in Greece, have never seen.
So widespread public anger. There was a report out yesterday into the crash. I mean, who did that and what did they find?
This was an independent investigative committee of experts at the Athens Polytechnic University. It was a 178-page report that was produced in English into this disaster and what caused it. And the conclusion was there were systematic failures, human error, and outdated infrastructure. It was believed, and certainly the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis was quick to say, that the accident itself was triggered by human error, by the failure of a station master in the central Greek town of Larissa to change routes so that two trains found themselves on the same track for 12 minutes in the same direction, a freight train from northern Greece and this intercity passenger train traveling the Athens-Thessaloniki route, until they both collided in what was a massive head-on collision that set off an extraordinary explosion. Now, the report says, and this has made people very angry, possible traces of unknown fuel. And this has boosted the belief that the freight train was carrying illegal cargo of highly inflammable materials, substances, probably explosive chemicals, that were being smuggled. And this is what has upset relatives of victims so very much.
And so are people fearful that that's why the government is dragging its feet with its own inquiry, that it's trying to hide something?
Yes, that's absolutely right. There is a widespread and growing perception of a government cover-up. It is extraordinary, despite the fact that the Greek justice system does work at a glacial pace, that 2 years on, there's almost nothing tangible that the relatives of these victims, most of whom were young kids, were students, can lay their hands on. And so the relatives of victims have found themselves playing detectives rather than being able to mourn their own kith and kin 2 years on.
And just briefly, I mean, it's hard for any government to ignore the sort of scale of the protests that we've seen today. Has it had anything to say in response? What's its version of events?
In response, no. Ahead of the protest, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the Greek Prime Minister, did warn against the demonstrations being weaponized by opponents of the government, including the political opposition. So the political atmosphere here in Greece is extremely toxic, and political commentators are describing it as extremely unpredictable. And all of this from a centre-right government that in 6 years of power has never faced such unrest and has been seen as a pillar of stability in the region and in the country itself.
That was Helena Smith, who reports for The Guardian from Athens. To the Middle East now, because talks began today in Cairo between Israel and Hamas about the next stage of the ceasefire agreement. Phase one is due to expire on Saturday, although it seems the truce will remain in force while those negotiations continue. Paul Adams is our correspondent in Jerusalem and joins us now. Paul, what are they discussing exactly?
I wish I could tell you. It is frankly as clear as mud, but the reporting suggests that what the Israelis are trying to engineer is an extension, essentially, of phase one, which, as you say, was due to end tomorrow. Now, all the kind of the things that were supposed to happen during phase one have happened. All of these swaps of hostages alive and dead and the release of Palestinian prisoners. Phase two was going to see that continue with the release of all remaining living hostages and, crucially, Israel's military withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Now, the general belief is that Benjamin Netanyahu is gearing up for, ultimately, a return to war, and that what he is trying to do in the meantime is to extend phase one, get more hostages out, and in the words of one commentator on this, essentially shrink the hostage problem to a more manageable level.
Right. Okay. Because he's reluctant to withdraw troops from the Gaza Strip altogether.
Yes. I mean, clearly it is a major preoccupation for the Israeli government that Hamas, far from being obviously defeated, seem very determined to put on these displays of strength, which we've seen every time hostages have been released. Now, we don't know whether those displays really are indicative of a properly functioning organization, but clearly it's enough to make the Israeli government worried that it has not achieved everything that it set out to achieve in the war in Gaza, and that ultimately a return to military action is inevitable.
Paul, I wanted to ask you about one other story. This report by the Israeli military into what happened on October the 7th, 2023. What's in it? I mean, is there anything that we didn't suspect or know already?
Not really, no. I mean, the appalling events of that day have been so pored over and examined that there's, in some ways, very little left for the public to know, except perhaps, and this is what the Prime Minister's critics highlight, failings at the top, at the political echelon. But what the army has done, finally, is to publish, and it is, you know, pretty extraordinary in some ways to see it in black and white, a whole catalogue of errors, from intelligence failings, from a kind of wrong assumptions about what Hamas was doing and what its intentions and capabilities were, and the inability to respond effectively on October the 7th, 2023. To see all of that in black and white is still pretty remarkable, but I think the general Israeli public believes that there are an awful lot of questions, political questions, that still remain to be answered. Of course, Mr. Netanyahu's argument is all of these questions will be answered once the war is finally over.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Paul Adams, our correspondent, joining us live there from Jerusalem. Now, another of the hopefuls for the Oscar for Best Documentary on Sunday is Black Box Diaries by the Japanese journalist Shiori Ito. She became a symbol of Japan's Me Too movement 10 years ago when she filed a rape charge against another high-profile journalist, Noriyuki Yamaguchi. Her decision to defy societal norms and speak out generated a huge public response. However, despite being shown in more than 50 countries around the world, Mizuto's film has still not been screened in Japan. Our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil caught up with her in Paris, where she was promoting her film.
Black Box Diaries, which is Shiori's directorial debut, is based on her memoir. It follows the young reporter's quest for justice in a rape criminal case she filed in 2015 against well-known journalist Noriyuki Yamaguchi, who also had a close relationship with the late former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe as his biographer. Shiori decides to go public after the police and the prosecutors dismiss her allegations for lack of evidence. In 2019, she won a civil case against Yamaguchi, who's always denied the allegations. In doing so, Shiori became the symbol of the Me Too movement in Japan.
It was like a hardcore exposing therapy session in a way. But after making this film, I truly think that was very therapeutic. I want to break the idea of perfect victim, because that was what stopping me, people telling me, you're not crying enough during talking to the policeman, you're not wearing proper clothes when I'm doing press conference. There are moments I'm not proud of, but I want to put all of it in.
The film has been screened in dozens of countries and is now in the running for Best Documentary Feature Film at this year's Academy Awards. Shiori is the first Japanese director to be nominated in this category.
It took some moment to understand we really got in. It was almost 11 p.m. in Japan time, so everyone was at my home in Tokyo, my best friend who's been always supporting me, and all the film crew, so we just cried with joy.
Despite the international acclaim, the film has not yet been shown in Japan. Lawyers who led the team representing Shiori's successful civil lawsuit in 2019 have now criticized the documentary publicly, taking issue with the film's unauthorized use of CCTV footage that they say was only supposed to be used in court proceedings. The footage shows an intoxicated Shiori being dragged from a taxi and into a hotel lobby by the alleged perpetrator. The lawyers also said that her using secret video and audio recordings without consent has compromised sources who should have been protected.
We are standing in different point of view. For me, public good. For them, do not break any rules. CCTV footage is the only evidence visually when we have to think about what we have to tell through this story, including the voice of investigator who was the part of the cover-up, the investigation.
In a recent statement, Shiori apologized to those whose identities she revealed in the film and said she would re-edit parts of it. It's not clear what the re-edited version will look like or if it will be shown here in Japan.
What I wish is to be able to screen this film so people can catch it, people can see it. This is my love letter to Japan. That's what I really hope, more than winning Oscars.
And that was Shiori Itu talking to our Tokyo correspondent Shama Khalil about her documentary Black Box Diaries. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Now, weather forecasters and climate scientists are the latest federal workers in the US to come into Elon Musk's crosshairs as he tries to cut government spending. On Thursday, nearly 900 people at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, were laid off. That's out of a total staff of about 12,000 around the world. One Democratic congressman has warned the cuts would endanger lives. While Tom DiLiberto is a climate scientist and a science communicator based at NOAA's headquarters in Washington, D.C., or he was until yesterday. Tom, welcome to the program, and I'm sorry about your job. What happened?
Yeah, thank you for having me, first of all. And yeah, about yesterday afternoon, we, along with about 900 of the people at NOAA, received a boilerplate email telling us that our skills and abilities were no longer needed at the agency.
Without any warning.
Without any warning, yeah. Now, we had known, based upon all the other folks across the U.S. government that had been funded, that this was a potential thing that might happen. But still, it's never good to get.
My understanding is this was aimed at what are known as probationary workers at the administration. I mean, what does that mean in practice? To the outsider, it sounds like it may be people who've just been there for a few weeks, but that's not the case, is it?
No, not at all. I've actually worked at NOAA since 2010. I started at NOAA as a contractor. I worked there for 13 years before I finally became a federal employee a little less than 2 years ago. My actual probationary period ends on March 13th, so I was about 2 weeks away from my probationary period ending. And that's true for a lot of people who just got fired. These are not newbies at NOAA. These are folks who spent decades of time working at NOAA who just finally became federal employees.
And what does that mean for the legality of the action? Probationary employees, are they easier to get rid of?
Yes, we don't have as many protections as a full federal employee does, which is why we were all basically fired as we were. And it's 100% illegal because this was not done due to any performance reason. It was simply done because they wanted to cut people that they could.
And you have a disability, is that right?
Right. I have ADHD, which makes me a special Schedule A hire. And that's the only reason why I have a 2 year probationary period is because I was a specific Schedule A hire. Otherwise, I would have had a 1 year probation and I would have been past that by now.
What is this going to mean for the work that NOAA does, do you think?
It means that we are going to have less people having eyes on the sky and in our ocean, and it's only going to lead to there being potential problems. The people at NOAA are unbelievably great employees, but they're not magicians. They can't do things whether there's too many extremes happening across the country or across the globe. And for the entire planet, really, now there's going to be a giant blind spot when it comes to the United States, when it's clear that this government that's currently in charge does not care about science and does not care about weather, climate, and our ocean.
Even though that obviously affects, ordinary American families who need to know if something extreme is approaching their home.
Exactly right. So we know weather and climate affects everybody. It makes no sense whatsoever to decide that, you know what, we need to take a hit out on all the people who are making sure that folks across the entire country and even the globe are prepared for the weather and climate extremes that are coming. It makes no sense.
Just finally, what are you going to do? You're considering your own legal challenge. I noticed that there was a judge in San Francisco that suggested federal sackings more broadly, will also apply to what's happening in NOAA. Do you think you have a good case?
I think I do have a good case. I'm following very closely not only the rulings from the judges, but class action lawsuits that are going on across the country, because a lot of us, we're not going to take this quietly, because all we want to do as federal employees is help other people. And the idea that that is somehow a bad thing is just crazy.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Tom DiLiberto, climate scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The renowned British composer Sir Edward Elgar, back in 1905, completed Introduction and Allegro, a work for strings that took some time to be appreciated, but it's now seen as a showcase for melodic inventiveness. After he wrote the piece, Elgar gave 15 pages of a draft notation to a friend. Well, they've now been bought by the British Library and given insight into the creation and development of Elgar's work. My colleague Johnny Diamond has been talking to Sandra Tappan, who's the head of music collections at the Library, and asked her why the drafts are important.
These newly acquired sketches, which haven't been seen by scholars before, are the bridge between those very early preliminary sketches and the final version. They're much more substantial than anything we've had in the collection before. And they're important, I think, because they shine a light on how Elgar composed the piece.
It must be hugely exciting to have that bridge. What does it tell you when you look at it in detail?
Well, Elgar was somebody who did a lot of sketching out of his ideas when he was composing. And in this manuscript, we see him jotting down particular ideas for the piece, expanding them, working on them, crossing out particular sections. One of the tunes within the manuscript that's particularly well known is the Welsh tune, which is so called because Elgar apparently was inspired to compose it when he was on holiday in Wales. And this particular tune appears several times in the manuscript. First of all, just as a solo melody, and then with the harmony with Elgar fleshing out his ideas, and then finally the full version for strings as it appears in the final manuscript.
Sandra Tappan of the British Library. Well, Debbie Wiseman's a composer and visiting professor at the Royal College of Music and has a copy of those drafts by Elgar, including the first elements of that very tune.
Well, I'm looking at them now, and there's this wonderful, lovely melody, which Elgar himself referred to as the Welsh tune. He'd been on holiday in West Wales. He was inspired to write down the melody after he heard some distant singing of Welsh tunes. And you can just see it in the draft. It's very simple. I'm at the piano now. Yeah. I'll just play what's in this draft. You hear on the viola, you hear throughout the string orchestra. Elgar had a real and deep understanding of string instruments. He was a violinist himself, so he wrote innovatively for strings. He expanded what was possible. He gave the cellos and basses equal roles alongside the violins and violas. And that was because he really understood how to write the string players.
Composer Debbie Wiseman taking Johnny Diamond through those drafts of Elgar's work. And that is just about it for this edition of NewsHour from me and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks so much for listening. We'll leave you with a more polished version of the Welsh tune by Elgar. It's played by the string ensemble A Far Cry.